Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and we're looking at what it takes to drive peak performance in your career and in your organization. We have a phenomenal panel here, some of the top HR professionals in the region, starting with Julian Frankham, who's the Chief Executive Officer for the Middle East and Africa for RP International, one of the world's leading executive search firms. He places high-powered executives in the top jobs. Julian, welcome to Eye on Careers.
Thank you very much, Shane. Thanks for having me.
So you you had the joy of actually starting a business, I believe it was in the financial crisis.
Well, not exactly, but it was quite a journey. We, my partners and I were working in different organizations, and we realized that the international worlds were deregulating in terms of telecommunications and technology. So we decided deregulating around the world, that means new companies, they would need people. So we started an organization to try and address those needs.
And that was in 2008 or
2009? Well, no, 1998 is when we started the organization, 2002 when we actually came to Dubai.
Okay, but you joined in the Middle East in 2008.
Much later. 2009 when I came to the Middle East.
Which was a crisis.
Right. Absolutely.
So that's a fun time to kick things off.
Yeah, it wasn't great. You know, you need a certain style of leadership at that point to reassess who you are, where you're going, and how to actually put the company in such a structure that you can actually get through that period and come out the other side of it. Luckily for me and my partners, it wasn't the first recession we'd been through, so we had some idea of what to do.
I've seen your fair share of bulls and bears, but you said when you started the business back in the 90s, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
And so you said there was a few things you did right to kind of, you know, build a base or build a foundation to grow on. Sometimes partnerships can go awry.
Yeah, well, it's one of those things that I look back on now. We set up to do this international market, and actually looking back, if I'd have known how hard it was to actually operate internationally, I would never have done it. But we, you know, we embarked on that trip, and we picked the right market at the right time. That was fine. Between the partnership, we had a very, very good chairman at the time who was very good at asking us some very searching questions about the business and some very personal questions about the business, about what did we both want out of it? You know, how is we going to be structured? What do we want in the future? And actually, my major shareholder partner and myself had some very, very different ideas on that. And that wasn't really an issue, but so long as we were aware that we both had slightly different agendas so we could work to each other's tune, as it were, to complement it and then try and satisfy things going forward.
Right. And so when you took off out of the gates, how were your first few clients? Did you have trouble finding your revenue stream, or was it instant success?
No. Luckily, we picked the markets very, very well. We started off in telecommunications, which is an enormous market. There's the commercial side, the IT side, the network side. And we picked one very small part of that and focused on that. And we started off doing some work in Brazil that then led to dealing with the companies in Paris and other parts of the world, just focusing on that particular market. And once we got that nailed, only then did we start looking at some alternative markets within the telecom space. But it was important to try and stay narrow and stay focused at first.
What do you think was the biggest challenge of taking on something like starting your own business?
I think that was the main thing, actually, just remaining focused. It's too easy to be like a kid in a sweet shop and see so many opportunities for recruitment within that particular sector and go after everything. But then you'll just spread yourself so thin, you'll become an expert in nothing. And it was much better to just bide your time, get the business locked down, understand what you were doing, who you were, what your capabilities were, and then take it from there on a gradual basis.
So focus is the number one thing.
Yeah, it was at the time, definitely.
And, you know, I guess you're focusing on what's your profit per X. What you're really talking about is what's actually bringing in the money rather than going after opportunity.
Yeah.
Do you feel that's one of the big mistakes business owners make?
Well, it's very easy to get carried away. You know, it's this business is my baby, as it were, and you get very passionate about it, about who you are and what you are, and sometimes it is possible to lose sight of what's the end game, why are you doing this in the first place, and you've got to be subservient to the goal, the ultimate goal, and just make sure that you focus on that and you know, where the revenue is going to come from.
Do you see a big change in the job market from, you know, you've been, you know, placing people since the 90s. Now we're halfway through the second decade in the 21st century. Is it what are some major themes that you've seen in terms of change?
Well, if you talk in terms of Dubai, there's a huge change. We turned up here in 2002 when the market was still relatively new. And but of course, it's far more mature. The clients are much more discerning. They have these wonderful things like LinkedIn, who very happily took our coin during the times when they were selling to the agencies. Now they're very happily selling to the end clients and saying, look, you don't actually need the fees from the agencies. You can use this yourself. There's still a place for an organization like ours that specializes in a particular market. And if you don't mind, if you forgive the phrase, we know where the bodies are buried, because this is what we do for a living. We're constantly mapping the market for good talent, understanding who's good, who's not so good, and then, you know, taking that to the client and being, you know, consultative about how you do that.
I don't understand this, because, you know, they say, oh, LinkedIn is so great. You know, I'm obviously in the same industry as you. I do executive search as well. And we have all the tools and all the kit and everything else, probably better than most HR departments. And I've never had an easy assignment. I'm saying, oh, it's so easy. Just go on LinkedIn, get the guy. No, never works like that, right? You have to do hours and hours and hours of research and interviews and calls, like you said. So is LinkedIn really eating into executive search?
I think it's giving clients an alternative to the services we provide, you know, and it's going to be a natural maturation of the market that they're going to experiment with that, just in the same way that over the years in Dubai, they've experimented with creating their own internal resourcing teams, or they've gone down the outsource model and given their talent acquisition to outsource companies. So, you know, there is that element of it. But the thing is, forgive me for saying so, but an end client is all their internal recruitment team is always going to be slightly one dimensional. Why? Because they're only ever recruiting for themselves, whereas a recruitment organization, a search firm, is dealing with many, many different companies all the time. They do it 24/7. So they are constantly aware of trends in talent, where it's coming from, where to go and look, et cetera, et cetera.
What's the future of the search market? Will we eventually see, as you're saying, LinkedIn wipe the headhunters out, or will there be an evolution? Will there be a new space, new segment? What does it look like?
No. It won't wipe it out. As I say, the internal recruitment teams do tend to be one-dimensional. You still need companies that focus on certain markets, as I said earlier, who know where the good talent is, who know where the poorer talent might be, who know people's track records, who have the time and capacity and energy to map the market, to capitalize on their, you know, in my case, 20 years of building that particular market in that network.
So I just noticed that not only do we have a room full of very highly qualified professionals who can talk about peak performance and talent, but we also have a room full of entrepreneurs. So everybody on the panel has actually started and run a business. So that was not by planning. So that's pretty exciting. So Myra Roy, we have the founder of the Alpha Game. Welcome to Ion Careers.
Thank you, Shane.
Am I pronouncing the name?
That's right? Myra.
I'm all nervous now about it, but Myra. I've been friends with you for a long time, so I don't know why I'm having an issue with that. Clive Harrison, managing partner of Harrison Rudder and Associates. Welcome to Ion Careers.
Good evening, Shane. Thank you.
Both of you individuals also run your own businesses and are heavily involved in the selection and fine-tuning of executives in the region. How do you see this, talent, the war for talent, the job market actually evolving over the last decade or two? Clive, I think you've really been deep in this industry for a long time, one of the most accomplished HR professionals here in the region. What's been your take, as you sit on the other side of the desk of our friend here, Mr. Julian? So what's your take on it?
Indeed. I think there are two factors, certainly within the GCC region, which come into play. I think firstly is the fact that obviously we have a large transitory workforce, and that applies not only at blue collar, but right the way through to senior executive level. And because of that, I think that this region is characterized by turnover, which is perhaps slightly higher than in other parts of the world. Some of the engagement type factors, which would often be enough to secure the long tenure of good employees in more developed markets, isn't necessarily holding true here, where people aren't going to necessarily look to stay in Dubai or the UAE or the GCC for the rest of their working lives. And so other factors, primarily financial, often come into play to a greater extent than they do in other markets. And I think second, in the Middle East, the same as everywhere else in the world. I think the Generation Y population certainly see employment as being much more transitory than perhaps their parents did, their grandparents did. And so because of that, I think that there will always be a heavy focus on recruiting the right people, but then also making sure that you have measures in place to engage that population so that your best talent is going to contribute to your business or your organization over an extended period of time.
Myra, what do you see? You've also been in the region for a long time. You've worked in, I think, Bahrain as well as UAE and other regions, and I think you've been responsible, in fact, for the entire Middle East, North Africa, in a former life as a partner in one of the Big Four. What's your take on the job market out here?
Shane, it has changed a lot. I moved here in 2003, and since then, the market is much more mature. As Julian says, companies are much more discerning. There are some very highly qualified professionals here, much more than there were 12 years ago when I arrived. Companies are becoming very, very savvy with their recruitment process. It's no longer a case with a lot of them of just a hire and fire situation. They're assessing. They've got psychometric assessments, volumetric assessments, all forms of assessments. They've got processes in place. This is still a journey, though, for a lot of companies here. So whilst it's moved a lot in the last 10 or 12 years, there's still a long way to go. But people are much more aware that recruitment is not just about acquisition, not just about hiring. It's about retaining. It's about the entire employee life cycle. It's about ensuring that you're investing in assets rather than people just being an expense item in your profit and loss account.
Well, this is Eye on Careers, and coming up, we're going to look at what are some of the biggest challenges that these individuals have faced as they've run their businesses and service their clients, and we're also going to get some of their tips and tricks in driving peak performance in your own career, so stay with us.
This is Eye on Careers, keeping an eye on your career.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and we're looking at what it takes to drive peak performance in your life, in your career. And to help us with that, we have a peak performance panel, the PPP, as we like to call it. I just made that up, but it is peak performance panel. With not only do you have HR professionals who have, you know, decades of experience, but we also have three entrepreneurs who all run their own organization. So we have Myra Roy, who's the founder of the Alpha Game. Welcome back to Iron Careers.
Thank you, Shane.
I love the name, by the way, the Alpha Game. Sounds like it'd almost be a movie. You know,
Maybe one day.
Yeah. Julian Frankham, the Chief Executive Officer for the Middle East and Africa for RP International. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Clive Harrison, Managing Partner, Harrison Rudder and Associates.
Welcome back. Shane. Thank you.
So what, both of you, I mean, we've heard your story just now, Julian, of how you started up and some of the challenges you had. Myra, you've just started the Alpha Game. What are some of the challenges you face as you get out of the gates?
The biggest challenge for us is visibility, awareness. Although we operate in the people space, what we provide in terms of helping businesses and organizations focus on areas which will extract the best performance out of their people, those kind of services are most times services people are not aware of, or they don't know what they're looking for if they don't know about it. So our marketing is very education based, so we've got to get out there, educate people about what we provide, how it can make a difference to the bottom line. And so it's not a case of telling people about the products and services we provide per se, but how the kinds of services we provide can make a difference to the bottom line. So our approach to marketing is slightly different. It is challenging because it's not a case of somebody going on Google and typing in a specific word and coming up with our services. If they don't know what to type in, they won't know what they're looking
for. Are people in the Middle East Googling peak performance? Is that happening, or is that what you're saying, that's not happening?
It's not happening as much as I'd like it to happen. No, unfortunately.
So we'll talk a little bit more about that later in the show. But Clive, how about you? I mean, you made the switch. You were one of the, head of HR, Chief Human Resource Officer. Business development, marketing, branding, these are not necessarily things that fell on your desk. You start your own business and now, you know, you either have a white knuckle grip of these items or you go out of business. So
yes.
Obviously you jumped in deep end and learned how to swim. But what were some of the big challenges you faced as you started?
I think the prime thing goes back to something that Julian said just a few minutes ago in terms of keeping the faith, as it were, in terms of reminding yourself perhaps when cash flow isn't as healthy as you might have anticipated, exactly why you decided to do this in the first place. My background was in consulting with one of the global HR consultancies previously, both in Europe and the MENA region. And so this wasn't completely new. Mm-hmm. I personally feel that in order to be a well-rounded individual in whatever your field or specialism, it's advantageous to spend certain periods in line management roles and also in a consulting perspective so that you have the opportunity to see life from both sides of the fence, as it were. I think it makes you a better line manager and I think it makes you a better consultant. So the opportunity to return to consulting, but perhaps on my own terms rather than the terms of an employer, was something that I really looked forward to doing for a couple of years before we started the business. So the challenges, I think, have been not only for myself but also for my partners as well, being around being strong in terms of the vision that we set out for the organization and making sure that we continue to act in a manner consistent with that.
Right, and I think at the end of the day, you know, businesses want to find their alpha, and you know that's almost like the title of your company is you know, I think it's cool, like, you know, the alpha game, and you know, at the end of the day, we want to get that peak performance. But what are some of the traits? I mean, I think you can almost sit there and, you know, I've started meetings before and say, well, you know, what's a top performer? What does that look like? Maybe we can just take a sample from all of you. Like, what do you think are really, you know, how do you identify them? What are some of the traits you look for? What is it that makes a champion win? Clive, we can start with you.
Yeah.
Or unless Myra wants to. Who's
sure.
hungry? Who wants it?
Sure. For me, it's really simple. I believe that the ability to do the right thing at the right time and in the right way is crucial for anyone across whatever the positions are. Now, this could be translated into several traits depending on the context of the situation. And for example, if you look at a leadership position, the two key areas we would always look for would be self-awareness and self-actualization. And within this, traits would be, you're looking at traits such as envisioning an outcome, communicating your vision, understanding your supporters and your people, inspiring others, influencing others. So it depends from role to role, but the most important thing is to be able to do the right thing at the right time and in the right way, and to have that, the recognition of what is right and when it's right.
Right, and you test for that.
Yes, we do. We can help with that. We don't just assess for that, but we also coach for that and we train for that.
Okay. Julian?
Well, I think there's a lot of sort of characteristics you could write down in terms of, you know, have realistic optimism, you know, possess some self-confidence without delusion. As I've said before, be subservient.
Sorry, without, what was the delusion?
Possess confidence, but without delusion. So in terms of, you know, be realistic, but be optimistic, but, you know what your limitations are, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And I think touching on that, know what your limitations are, and don't be a slave to your ego. You know, that's very, very important indeed. But again, going back to what I said, be subservient to the purpose of why you started that business. You know, your goal must be your master. The problem you have in Dubai as well is that, or in the Middle East, is that it itself is a very, very fast changing dynamic market. And what was good and working for your company yesterday may not be what it is today and may not be what it is tomorrow. And it's almost like a game of rugby. You've got to play heads up rugby. You can't just keep on following the ball and just hoping that'll take you to winning the game. You've got to, you know, step back, look at the market, constantly reassess what is the market doing, what is it telling you, and also, are you as an organization and as an individual equipped to deal with what, you know, what it's going to bring to you?
Well, in your job, you have to sit down and very quickly assess, you know, is this a top performer? Is this someone who's going to drive peak performance in my client's organization? Are there certain things, so this is what some of the things you would be looking for. Are there certain questions you ask, or, you know, if I gave you, you know, 10 people without giving you their CVs, and telling you to come out with who you think the top performer is, what would you look for?
Well, I think the first thing you've got to know is what stage that client, that employer is at. You know, are they a startup organization or are they a mature organization? Because the people you want to be the leadership team of those organizations are very, very different individuals with different skills. I myself, I'm good at startup. I'm not actually very good at running a company. And we took a decision a few years ago to bring on a guy called David Higgins, who is our chairman now. He was the founder of Harvey Nash, one of the biggest agencies in the world. So he had that dimension around our board table that we were sadly lacking. And so, you know, we recognized that and got him on board. And I think that's what you've got to do. So you look at the client you're dealing with at the time, find out what stage they're at, and then you need to recruit in sympathy with
that. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, you know, people, when they get fired, they take it sometimes as a negative, but it could be, you know, you're a champion, you're just in the wrong organization, you're like, as you said, maybe I'm a startup personality in a steady state business, or I'm a steady state personality in a startup environment, you know, and it could be a good sign that you got fired. Clive, what do you see as some of the traits?
Well, I think the key to it all, and sorry if this is a little bit overarching, but I think the key is flexibility, and it's flexibility of leadership style. I think once we get to a senior executive level, the technical skills, hopefully, we can take as a given. A good senior executive will develop over time a toolkit, if you like, of behavioral leadership styles. And the good leaders are those who can understand a situation and understand which tools they need to bring out of that toolkit and utilize within any given circumstances. So whilst certain situations may require an individual to do something different to the way that they perhaps have behaved before, those who are able to make that step and do things differently, primarily in terms of how they manage people and how they lead people, will be the successful executives.
So an agility in operating style and communication style.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's all back to emotional intelligence. Emotional intelligence in its distilled version is the ability to build successful relationships by modifying one's own behaviors and understanding the impact of one's behaviors on others. And that is what true leaders do well. That is what differentiates good leaders from the rest.
And, in my humble opinion, I look at how you develop this. This is the role of a mentor, right? You know, how are you going to learn a different communication style than your own? How are you going to have the confidence to say, here's a problem, I'm going to try it from a way that would be abnormal for me, that would be foreign for me, indeed, when I'm under pressure to perform and I'm being under KPIs and everything else, and if I get this wrong, I could kill my career.
Absolutely.
So is the subtext of that saying, you know, mentorship plays a big role? Should people find senior people to lead them through different stages of their careers?
No, absolutely. I think both mentorship and coaching, and I think it's important to make the distinction between the two. Coaching services, such as those provided by Myra or ourselves, very much hold a mirror up, if you like, to an individual to allow them to reflect on the impact that their behavior has on others. A mentor is probably somebody who will provide longer-term guidance in terms of general career direction. I think both are important. I myself have benefited hugely earlier in my career from a very successful mentoring relationship, which intermittently I still maintain now. I've also used an external coach on a couple of occasions, which again I've found to be hugely beneficial. Senior executive roles, especially those of general manager or CEO, can be very, very lonely. And I think apart from anything else, the ability to have a neutral, non-prejudiced sounding board who's not necessarily going to tell you what to do or tell you what the answer is, but allow you to reflect and to think about what you did well, where you might look to do things differently in the future, is hugely powerful in terms of driving performance at an executive level.
Sometimes it can be a lifesaver too if you, you know, if you have a heated moment, rather than send that email or make that phone call, just to pump the brakes and talk to someone else about it could be a lifesaver. Julian, you look like you were going to say something, or
I agree, and I was agreeing with Clive. I'm very lucky. Good leaders are born, and some of them are very good and very natural at it. Some of us aren't. I'm not, and I work on it. I work at it, and I have to work at it. And we were very lucky a few years ago to find a psychometric profiler that we started working with. And this guy, he's like working with Darren Brown. He's almost like a magician in terms of the way he can actually read people. He can describe in absolute detail people in my office that he has never met, simply from their psychometric profiles. So what I did when I first came out to Dubai is I did my profile again, I did everyone's in the office again, and I sat down with this guy for hours and hours and said, okay, what is it about me that's going to motivate these people? What is it about me that's going to rub them up the wrong way? How do I get the most out of this individual, that individual? And periodically I do it again. But it's something you really have to work at. And I tell you what, it pays dividends. It really, really does. It's amazing how tangible the results can be, not just for yourself, but for everybody that you work with.
Coming up, we're going to look at how to win the interviewing game and how having the right psychometric information can really help you achieve peak performance. So stay with us.
This is Eye on Careers, keeping an eye on your career.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and we are looking at the Peak Performance Panel. We are looking at what it takes to drive peak performance in your life, in your career, in your organization. If you're a leader, you need to drive peak performance in your team. If you're a team member, you need to drive peak performance in your team as well. Actually, it's the same thing. No, but, you know, what does it look like? What's the toolkit? What can you do starting, you know, this coming work week? What can you do to make some changes? We're going to look at that right now. We have some of the top HR professionals in the GCC here in the studio to help us unearth the answers to this. First, we have Clive Harrison, managing partner of Harrison Rudder and Associates, and one of the most experienced HR professionals here in the region. Clive, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
Thank you, Shane.
We have one of the most celebrated executive search consultants here in the region, Julian Frankham, the chief executive officer for the Middle East and Africa for RP International. Welcome back, Julian.
Thanks, Shane.
And we also have the founder of the Alpha Game, Myra Roy. Welcome back.
Thank you, Shane.
When we look at you know, everything we've just talked about, you know, what some of the traits are for a top performer. Clive, you mentioned agility and operating and communication style, emotional intelligence. You know, I think Julian, you mentioned the importance of confidence, self-confidence, but also realism, not arrogance or delusion. But delusion has served some leaders well, but maybe it's not something you want to bank on. Myra, you had a whole slew of them, from self-awareness to self-actualization to energizing others and doing the right thing at the right time. But if you missed any of that, you can go to our website and catch it on our podcasts. Also, if you had a question for the group here, you can SMS us at 4001. I think a lot of people out there are saying in the sandstorm to keep your lights on, that it's a little bit dangerous out there, but we don't have any accidents reported. Yeah, which is a good thing. So when you look at it, you know, you're having all this emotional intelligence coming into the workplace, and you know, you're having people, you know, using terms like we need to self-actualize, and we need to, you know, optimize our team, and you know, we need to create the right personalities. And it really says that, you know, the future managers need to be socially conscious, they need to be emotionally intelligent, and emotionally advanced. And you know, do we have that in the market? You know, are we really seeing this growth of the emotionally intelligent manager, or are we still kind of light years away from that happening? Myra, you look like you have an answer to that.
Yes, I think it's happening. It started. It is a work in progress. It's like the world, I mean, if you look at it, the world's been trying to eradicate poverty for the last X number of decades. So it's a journey. The important thing about emotional intelligence is it's an ideology. It is a journey. It's not a destination. So when people start that journey, they realize that it's not a tick the box exercise, and it's a long road, and they don't really arrive. And when you look at emotionally intelligent businesses, the measure of an emotionally intelligent business is not the absence of people issues. It's more how they handle people issues, the progress related to handling issues and resolving issues. So this will take time. It's happening. It's slowly taking its own shape in life, and I think we have to be patient. But we're definitely much further down the road than we were 10 years ago in this region.
I think it's a lot harder here as well, Shane, because don't forget we're privileged to be working in an environment where most of us work in offices where there is a multitude of nationalities there, and the different cultures and the mix of their backgrounds will mean that you have to handle things in a very, very different way for each individual. What will work for someone from, say, Europe might not be the same from the Philippines, for example.
Right, so you're seeing that pressure on being culturally agile.
Definitely.
And Clive?
I think also that what we're seeing is the increased role of corporate governance in terms of the way that businesses are run across the GCC region. I hope I'm not going to get myself into trouble by saying that perhaps a few years ago the corporate governance practices of some organizations within the region weren't perhaps as sophisticated as in other developed parts of the world. I think we've seen a huge change, both sponsored by central government and also from within organizations themselves, whereby it's not just the shareholder who is of primary importance and whose concerns must be addressed, it's all stakeholders. So that includes customers, it includes employees, it includes the communities in which organizations operate. So because of this change, the behaviors and the attitudes of organizations and the managers within those businesses has been changing at a very, very rapid rate as well. And I think that certainly if you look at the corporate governance practices and not only the statute of the practice but also the behaviors which accompany that, there has been a huge change. Voltfas, in terms of the 16 years that I've been working in the region. And I think that is a trend, obviously, which will continue, because sustainable businesses consider more than just the shareholder, they consider all stakeholder groups.
As we're in pioneering markets, they are largely inefficient. I actually just came back from Ethiopia, and in Ethiopia, in Addis Ababa, there's no Burger King, McDonald's, Krispy Kreme. Therefore, you know, hypothetically, if I bought the rights for Krispy Kreme to Ethiopia, you know, anybody who wants that type of donut has to come. You know, am I really concerned about self-actualizing my staff when you have these kind of monopoly, duopoly, protectionist legislation? You know, how open or friendly will these pioneering markets be to such advanced management techniques?
Well, it's different. That's a very good question, actually. A pioneering market would be very different to a mature market. And that's where you've got to be flexible enough. You've got to be able to adapt. You've got to be creative. Yes, there may not be processes and controls and procedures, but maybe you have to take that initiative, which you wouldn't have had to take in another environment. So there's possibly an emphasis on certain skill sets that you might not necessarily need in other more mature environments, placed therefore in places in the Middle East and North Africa.
But I think Shane, we're back to good old Maslow here in terms of the hierarchy of needs, where in the truly frontier markets, You're right. I don't think that this self-actualization is a primary concern. Hopefully, the majority of citizens in those states have moved forward from the need for warmth, shelter, and food. But I think that you need to be able to manage in a much different way than you would be prepared to do in Dubai. And it's addressing primary needs rather than secondary or tertiary needs with the individual, which will be of primary importance. I think that obviously as most organizations evolve and as the societies in which those businesses operate evolve, then those needs change. But I think the successful manager in those circumstances will be able to assess what are the primary drivers of the working at the human capital and be able to develop tactics and strategies which make sure that those are satisfied.
So your opinion is, irrespective of what the state of the economy is, the manager who has some of these toolkits to help him become a more emotionally intelligent manager will have an edge over individuals who are not?
Well, I think it's more in terms of thinking about what is it that you need to do in order to engage your employees. And when we say engage employees, have them believe in your organization and be willing to expend discretionary effort in the cause of your organization. Now, having creches, having the offer of executive coaching, etc., in a state where the GDP per capita is less than $1,000 per person, is probably going to be little valued by the employee. Being able to provide education or transportation for that individual might be much, much more important and much, much more pragmatic.
How should executives now, on the individual level, you know, listen, maybe I'm not the CEO and have 2,000 staff. Maybe I'm, you know, just a mid-manager. I'm stuck in the engine or the belly of the bank and I want to, you know, poke my head out to be a segment head or something like that. Maybe there's a position open at Standard Chartered Bank or wherever you go, you want to go to these positions. How can I use this toolkit on my own? You know, what things can I do? Myra, would your system help me as an individual or is it already...
Well, you know, Shane, before on your own, before you come go to anyone for help, the first step, and you can do this yourself, is try to become more self-aware as an individual. Be more observant. Watch and assess. Look at yourself, you know, as if you're looking at somebody else. Look at how you like to do things, how you behave, what drives you to do certain things, what is it that you're inherently good at? What is it? What have you acquired as a skill set? Observe. Be aware of what you're able to sell. What is it that you can actualize and develop? I think that's the first step, and everyone can do that without having to go to another person or an external sounding board for help.
Right. I think Mara's touched on an interesting point there. You know, don't forget, a lot of us over here are very privileged expats who are in the region, but we are here because we often bring a very particular skill to the market. So, yeah, if you are that person that's putting your head above the parapet, you've got to sit down and reevaluate. Well, actually, do you know what? What is my skill set now? What have I learned over the last few years of perhaps being in the region? And what do I bring to the table now? It might be very different from when you very first arrived. And actually, perhaps what you're peddling right now isn't quite what's needed. So you need to maybe take advice, explore, speak to your peer group, and find out where is the market going and what are the skills that's going to be needed for tomorrow, not just for today.
Clive, what are some of the elements, you know, if we flip back to the organizational side of things, what are some of the elements that the organization needs to drive peak performance? I had a CEO recently, he said, you know, I just put in this KPI, this balanced scorecard, and he said it's just a complete waste because while we're going to have the best system in place, all it means is, you know, people are going to still game the system. They're just going to measure their performance differently, but the performance is going to stay the same. What's your take on this? What are some of the things you need to really drive peak performance?
I wouldn't say that a balanced scorecard approach doesn't have value. I group it within a heading of clarity. I think that clarity within an organization is hugely important, both in terms of employees understanding and having confidence that the organization knows where it's going strategically, that it understands its markets, and it's well positioned to capitalize upon those, but also in other perhaps less tangible elements, which ultimately come back to leadership. The leadership styles, the behaviors demonstrated, not from time to time, but every minute of every day by the leadership team of that organization. Do the behaviors essentially empower? Do they give flexibility? Do they give responsibility to employees? Do they engender a feeling of loyalty? Are rewards adequate? And I'm not talking about financial rewards. If somebody does a good job, are they praised for it publicly or privately? So ultimately, the factors which influence high performance within an organization are largely down to the behaviors of the leaders, and also demonstrating that the key tenets by which the organization operates and behaves are valued by them as an individual and are demonstrated by them on a consistent basis. So I don't want to be too flippant here, but irrespective of any problems that an organization may be experiencing, any problem, the answer is always leadership. Always.
There was a study that they looked at all the different types of incentives you can do to drive behavior, and there was one that clearly stood out, 300% more impact than anything else that you can do, and almost no manager and almost no company uses this incentive. We're going to talk about what that is in just a minute. This is Peak Performance on Eye on Careers.
This is Eye on Careers, keeping an eye on your career.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and we are looking at peak performance, how to achieve it in your career, how to achieve it in your organization. We're not talking about it anywhere else. We have a peak performance panel here, some of the top HR professionals in the region who are here to share their insights with us. We have Clive Harrison, who is the managing partner of Harrison Rudder and Associates. We have Julian Frankham, who is the chief executive officer for the Middle East and Africa for RP International. And we have Mara Roy, who is the founder of the Alpha Game. So welcome back, all of you.
Thank you.
And so we're just looking at, we're talking about one of the things that drive peak performance is the incentives there. So we looked at there's different types of incentives. And the study that I read said that 90% of managers don't use the most powerful incentive, which is giving feedback in front of the staff's loved ones, either spouse and children. So, the manager takes the performer out to dinner in front of the wife or husband and says, hey, Clive is such an amazing and emotionally intelligent leader. He's been able to drive peak performance in our team, and he has an agile operating style and communication style. It's amazing how he deals with all the different nationalities, blah, blah, blah. And, it costs nothing, except maybe the dinner, which can be expensive in Dubai, depending where you go. But why is it? Why are we not even using some of these least expensive, most impactful things? Do people really care about peak performance?
I think what you've highlighted is a marvelous example of intangible reward. I worked recently with an organization who weren't the highest payers in the market. In fact, they were below the lower quartile in terms of their salaries.
In the bottom 25%?
They were in the bottom 25%, yes. But their turnover was less than 5% in terms of their voluntary turnover, which in Dubai is extremely low. Now, the reason for this was not because of the fact that these individuals didn't have a choice. It was because of the fact that the organization took great care and was at huge pains to demonstrate an extremely meritocratic culture where individuals were confident that they would achieve appropriate reward, both financial and intangible, for the level of performance that they demonstrated. So undoubtedly, a lot of these individuals could have gone to their competitors for 20-25% higher salaries, but chose not to do so, voluntarily chose not to do so, because of the fact that they recognized that the environment in which they worked would reward them appropriately for the level of performance that they delivered.
And I think that goes back to one of the other comments. They were motivated to perform. And the important thing to remember is motivation is it's as a result of an emotion. And emotions are fleeting experiences. So it's not necessary for an individual to be self-motivated 24/7. So it's very important to create that emotion if you're a leader or a manager for others. And a good leader is not really one who's going to leave motivation to chance.
So you believe leaders should motivate their team?
Absolutely.
Do you guys all believe that you know a leader should motivate people? Or, you know, Jack Welch said if your people need to be motivated, you got the wrong people. Other people say, yeah, you have to motivate them. Some people are never motivated. Some people and other people jump out of the bed ready to go. What's your take, Clive?
I think that the level of motivation that an individual demonstrates in whatever environment is a factor of their engagement. And not wanting to sound like a broken record, which goes back to leadership behaviours more often than not. Within the Middle East and GCC especially market, the economies continue to do well. Private sector jobs continue to be created. And so individuals have choice. So if you don't continue to try and motivate your employees, your good ones will simply walk. And that will obviously have a disastrous long-term consequence for the organization.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, in this world, in this part of the world, if you don't continue to motivate, then it's going to have an extremely detrimental effect on the performance of the organization.
Yes, you're right. And also what I've noticed is in order to have high performers, you have to be able to create progress or create an experience of progress for individuals, some form of motivation. So yes, motivation must come from self, but it also sometimes needs to come from others. So it's a game, really. You've got to draw a nice balance there.
Right. For the rainy day when you're down and out, the manager who pulls you across the line.
Or for the sandstorm.
Julian, you're...
Yeah, well, I read somewhere that also the thing that a lot of companies and leaders underestimate is making their staff feel they've actually do something of value. They think it's just fine to make it transactional. You know, you do the sale, you get your commission. But, you know, you've got to actually try and describe or impart to your staff that actually what you're doing is something worthwhile. You know, in our case, for example, I can think of an individual who was a single mother in Johannesburg, where the level of security wasn't so good, and by finding her a job within this region, of course her life has been transformed into a sunny, tax-free, crime-free environment, you know, and we really have changed her life and that of her daughters. It's not just a transaction, and it, you know, if you can impart that upon the staff, I think that's just as motivational as some of their financial rewards and so on and so forth.
What is your advice to anyone out there who wants to reach peak performance in their life? Who wants to take this one first? Anyone?
I'm happy to. I think the most important thing is to develop self, to develop yourself. That's in order to maximize your potential, you need to constantly develop yourself. Equip yourself to perform better.
Make sure you're growing.
Learning.
I like to call it intellectual curiosity. You know, how many people, you know, do you have an intellectual curiosity about your profession? Clive?
I think it's, as Mara says, it's down to understanding yourself and your own strengths and your own areas for development. And on an ongoing basis, working at addressing perhaps some of the areas which require development, and thinking about how do I become more effective predominantly in building relationships with people. I'm not talking about somebody to whom you may in the future be married, but how do I make every interaction with another individual a positive experience for that person by my own behaviors? And it's difficult. It's hard. It's really hard. It requires a lot of hard work and self-sacrifice, and it's painful.
Isn't it, though, sometimes, you know, and I know this isn't the PC thing to do, but that negative experiences can also be a motivator. Sometimes people need a kick up the you-know-what rather than just all self-actualize and be all positive.
Absolutely. And that goes back to one of the earlier conversations we had in terms of flexibility of style. In that if we want to improve the level of standards, then from time to time, it's absolutely right to use a coercive leadership style. Absolutely right, in order to make individuals absolutely clear as to where acceptable norms and lines lie and if they are transgressing them, to make sure that they understand that in no uncertain times with a high level of clarity. So just because of the fact that we're looking at engendering motivation, it doesn't mean to say that we don't also have a role to play as managers, as executives, in terms of upholding standards and making sure that everyone within the organization is absolutely crystal clear as to what is acceptable and what is not.
Julian?
Yeah, I agree with what Mario was saying earlier on. You know, never stop learning, always seek advice and opinions of others. I think it's amazing as well, touching on what Clive was just saying there, how many organisations where their staff don't actually understand what is expected. It hasn't been communicated enough, and they actually don't know when they're underperforming. I know that sounds a bit obvious, but it does happen. And therefore, you know, if they don't understand that, how can they ever, you know, perform to what is expected?
Well, thank you so much. I think we're running out of time here. It went very fast. I think perhaps we can have another discussion sometime soon. So, Clive, thank you so much for coming.
You're welcome, and thank you.
That was Clive Harrison. He's a managing partner of Harrison Rudder & Associates, one of the leading HR consultancies here in Dubai. And you can also find out more about him online. Julian, thank you so much for taking the time to come and share your insights.
Thank you, Shane.
With us. Hopefully we can have you on again soon sometime. That's Julian Frankham, who's the Chief Executive Officer for the Middle East and Africa for RP International. Mara Roy, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Shane. My pleasure.
And you can find out more about what Mara does on The Alpha Game. It's a very interesting program that she does to help individuals drive peak performance in their organizations and in their careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips. Hoping the rest of your life is the best of your life. That's it for this episode of Eye on Careers.